Only fair, he thought. He surely will not go on yet. No, he must ask why I am here at this hour, and I must answer prettily. Are you one of the gardeners? The mild voice, after a brief silence, went on above his head. He replied, My lord knows and sees all, even as Ray, who gave him. Of his gardeners, I am the least. To that, the voice, But why do you linger in the garden after the time of leaving, when your fellows do honor to the hour of rest and take their meal? Joseph bowed his head still lower above his hands. My lord presides over the hosts of Pharaoh. He is greatest among the great of the land, he said appealingly. He is like Ray, who rides across the heavens in his bark with his train. He is the steersman of Egypt, guiding the bark of state after his will. He is next to Tot, who judges without distinction of persons. Bulwark of the poor, may his mercy fall upon me like to the satisfaction of the hungry. Like a garment to cover the naked, may his forgiveness come upon me, that I lingered at my work among his trees until the hour when he walks in the garden and was a stumbling to his path. Silence. Perhaps Petitpré was exchanging glances with his companions as they listened to this well-turned prayer, spoken in rather harsh pronunciation indeed, but apt in phraseology, and though formal, yet not without a note of real sincerity. Joseph could not see whether Potiphar looked at his train, but he hoped so, and waited. His sharp ears seemed to catch a faint laugh, as Potiphar replied, Zeal in office and industry at late hours, call not forth the master's wrath. You may breathe in peace, for it seems you love your task, and are skilled in its performance. Here Joseph thought best to lift his head and raise his eyes. Those deep, black Rachel eyes met in their upward gaze the master's mild and even sad ones, long-lashed and brown like the doe's. Veiled with pride, yet good-humoredly searching, they looked into Joseph's own. Potiphar stood there, tall and fat, and most elegantly clad, his hand on the rest of his tall walking-staff, a little way below the crystal knob on its end. Pine-cone and fan he held in the other hand. The bright-colored faience of his necklace was in a pattern of flowers. Leather gaiters protected his shins. Leather, papyrus, and bronze were the sandals he stood in, the points of which ran between his great and second toes. His finely shaped head was bent as he listened, and from the top of the brow dangled a lotus flower. How shall I not love the gardener's art, answered Joseph, and be zealous therein, my lord, when it is pleasant in the eyes of gods and men, and the work of the hoe exceedeth in beauty that of the plough, as well as many others, if not the most. For it is an honor to the man, and many chosen ones practiced it in ancient time. Was not Ishulanu gardener to a great god, and found favor in the eyes of the daughter of Sin, and brought her daily blossoms, and made her table smile? I have heard of a child whom they exposed in a basket of rushes, but the stream bore him to Akki, the water-carrier, who taught the boy the art of gardening. And to Sharuk Inu, the gardener, Ishtar gave her love and her kingdom. And another king, Uraimitti of Isin, changed places in jest, I have heard, with Elilbani, his gardener, and set him on his throne. And lo, then Elilbani sat there, and himself remained king. Well, well, said Petitpré, and cast another smiling glance at Montcalm, who was shaking an embarrassed head. So were the scribes, and most of all Dudu the dwarf. Only little Shepsis Bess wrinkled his face with delight. But whence have you all these tales? Are you from Carduniash, then? The courtier said, in Akkadian, meaning Babylonia. Joseph answered in the same tongue. It was there my mother bore me, my lord. But 'twas in the land of Zehai, in a valley of Canaan, that your slave grew up, among his father's flocks. Ah, was all he heard Petitpré say. The master liked to speak Babylonian, and a certain poetic timbre in the reply, vaguely like a quotation, particularly in the phrase, his father's flocks, arrested him, and embarrassed him at the same time. An aristocratic dread of evoking intimacy, of hearing things that did not concern him, conflicted with the curiosity already quite lively, and the desire to hear more from these lips. "But you speak not badly," he said, "the tongue of King Kadashmansharbe." And falling back into Egyptian, "Who taught you the fables?"
"I read them, my lord, with my father's oldest servant."
"So you can read, then?" asked Petitpré, glad to express legitimate surprise, and not wishing to hear more of the father and the eldest servant, or that the father had a servant at all. Joseph bowed his head, not merely inclined it, but rather as though he admitted guilt.
"And write?"
The head went lower still.
"What work was it," the other asked, after a moment's hesitation, "which made you linger?"
"I was putting the blossoms to ride, my lord."
"Ah! And is that a male or female tree behind you?"
"It is a fruit-bearing one, my lord. It will bear. But whether one should call that male or female is uncertain. People disagree. In Egypt, they call male the fruit-bearing tree. But I have spoken with folk of the Isles of the Sea, Alatia and Crete, and these call the fruit-bearing ones female, and male the unfruitful, which only bear pollen and are barren."
"This is a fruit-bearing one, then," the captain of the guard said shortly.
"And how old is the tree?" he asked, since such a conversation could have but one purpose, an examination into Joseph's proficiency.
"It has blossomed for 10 years, my lord," he replied with a smile.
He spoke with a certain enthusiasm, partly out of his quite genuine feeling for trees, but also because it seemed useful.
"And it is 17 since its planting. In 2 or 3 years it will bear full crops and be at the height of its yield. Even now it bears close to 200 hin of the best fruit every year, of great beauty and size, and a fine amber color. That is, of course, if it is pollinated by hand instead of leaving it to the wind. It is a tree glorious among your trees," said he with a burst of enthusiasm, laying his hand on the slender shaft. "Male in the pride of its growth and strength, so that one feels inclined to call it so, as do the Egyptians. But on the other hand, female in its fruitful yield, according to the speech of the people of the islands. In short, it is a godlike tree, if your servant may unite in the word what is divided on the tongues of the peoples."
"So," said Petitpré teasingly, "you can talk of the nature of the divine as well. Do you worship trees at home?"
"No, my lord. Under trees, perhaps, but no more. We have reverent thoughts of trees, it is true. There is something sacred about them, and they say that they are older than the earth itself. Your slave has heard of the tree of life, with power to produce all living things. Shall one call that all-creative power male or female? Ptah's artists at Menfe and Pharaoh's here, who are fruitful of forms and fill the world with beautiful images, is their power male or female, begetting or bearing, which produces their works? We cannot tell, for the power is of both kinds, and the tree of life must have been hermaphrodite, two-sexed, as trees mostly are, and as Kepler is, the sun-beetle, who conceives himself. Lo, the whole world is divided in twain, and we speak of male and female, and cannot even agree in distinguishing between them, discussing whether the fruitful tree is male or the barren. But the bottom of the world and the tree of life are neither male nor female, rather both in one. And what does that mean? It means they are neither. Virgin are they, like the bearded goddess, and are father and mother at once to the thing they beget, for that they are above sex, and their power of giving has naught to do with being torn in twain."
Potiphar was silent, supporting his towering figure on his beautiful staff and gazing on the ground in front of Joseph's feet. He felt a warmth in his face, his breast, and all his limbs, a sort of dim stirring. It held him to the spot and would not let him go. And yet this man of the world knew not how to continue the conversation. His aristocratic dread of intimacy had made him avoid the subject of the young slave's personal life.
Now another sort of shyness seemed to bar this avenue as well. He might have gone and left the young foreigner standing by his tree, but that he could not do, nor did he wish to. He hesitated, and in the pause were heard the pompous accents of Dudu, the dwarf, spouse of Jesset, who took upon himself to say, "Were it not better to proceed toward the house, my lord? The fire of heaven pales, and at any moment a chill may blow up from the desert, giving him, without a coat, a cold in the head." To Dudu's annoyance, the fan-bearer heard him not at all. The warmth he felt closed his ears to the dwarf's sensible warning. He said, "A thoughtful gardener are you indeed, O Canaanitish youth." And returning to the word which had stamped itself on his mind, he said, "Were they numerous, your father's flocks?" "Very numerous, my lord. The land could scarce bear them." "Your father, then, was a man without care?"
"Save his care for God, my lord, he knew none."
"What is the care for God?"
"It is enlarged throughout the earth, my lord. With more or with less blessing and well-being, it is cherished by all the world. But especially was it from old time laid upon my people, so that my father, a king of his flocks, was also known as a prince of God."
"A king and a prince, you call him. Then you lived in great well-being in the days of your childhood?"
"Your servant," answered Joseph, "may say that he anointed himself with the oil of gladness in his childhood, and lived as of high rank. For the father loved him more than his brethren, and made him rich with the gifts of his love. He gave to him a sacred garment, where were woven many of the great lights and signs. A dissembling garment it was, and a coat of reversion, handed down from the mother's side, and he wore it in her place. But it was torn from him by the fang of envy." Potiphar had not the impression that he was lying. The youth's eye gazed into the past. The earnestness of his words spoke for him. There was a certain hesitation and vagueness which might be ascribed to his foreign tongue, and the details he gave were convincing.
"How then did you come?"
the other began to ask. He wanted to put the question delicately, and began again.
"How did your present, then, grow out of your past?"
"I died the death of my life," answered Joseph, "and a new one was vouchsafed me in your service, my lord. Shall I weary your ear with the circumstance of my story and the stages of it? I must call myself a man of sorrow and joy, for the favorite was driven into the desert, into misery. He was stolen and sold again. He drank deep of suffering after his joy. Grief was his bread, for his brethren hated him, and in their hate they laid snares about his steps. They dug a grave before his feet and thrust his life into the pit, so that darkness became his dwelling."
"Do you speak of yourself?"
"Of the least of your servants, my lord. 3 days he lay in bonds to the lower world, so that truly he stank, for he had fouled himself like a sheep with his own filth. Then came travelers with souls of mildness. They raised him forth in the goodness of their hearts, and freed him from the maw of death. They stilled with milk the newborn, and gave him a garment for his nakedness. But after that they brought him before your house, O Aki, great water-carrier, and you made him to be your gardener in the goodness of your heart, and to be a helper of the wind among your trees, so that his second birth may be called as strange as his first."
"What of his first?"
"Your servant hath blundered with his tongue. My mouth had no will to speak what it spoke."
"But you said your birth was strange."
"It escaped me, great lord, as I spoke before you. It was virgin."
"How can that be?"
"Lovely was my mother," Joseph said, "and Hathor had sealed her with the kiss of loveliness. But her body was closed for long years, so that she despaired of her motherhood, and no man could expect to see her loveliness bear fruit. But after 12 years she conceived and bore with unnatural pains what time the sign of the virgin rose in the east."
"Do you call that a virgin birth?" No, my lord, if it displease you. One cannot call it a virgin birth only because your mother bore you in the sign of the Virgin. Not therefore alone, my lord. One must consider further circumstances, the stamp of loveliness upon her brow, and that for so many years the womb of God's handmaid was closed. All this, together with the sign of the Virgin, makes it up.
But there is no virgin birth.
No, lord, as you say it.
Or is there, in your way of thinking?
Many thousand times, my lord, said Joseph joyously, many thousand times it comes to pass in the world, which is sundered in sex, and the universe is full of begetting and giving birth that is exalted high above sex. Does not a moonbeam bless the body of the cow awaiting the bull, and she bears happy? Does not old wisdom teach us that the bee is created out of the leaves of the trees? Then there are the trees, themselves the care of your servant, and their mystery, wherein creation plays her game with sex, putting it together into one, and dividing it among them according to her whim, and in one case one way and another, so that no one knows name and order of their sex, or if it is actually one, and the peoples disagree. For often it happens not at all through the sex that they propagate, but outside of it, not by pollination or conception, but by shoots or runners, or because they were planted, and the gardener sets out shots, but not kernels of the palm, that he may know whether he is growing a fruit-bearing or a barren one. But if they are propagated by their sex, then sometimes pollen and conception are put together in their blossoms, and sometimes divided among the blossoms of the same tree, but sometimes also among different trees in the garden, the fruitful and unfruitful, and it is the business of the wind to carry the seed of the pollen trees to those of the conception. But when one considers, is it thus truly a begetting and a conceiving in sex? Is not that which the wind does already quite like the begetting of the moonbeam upon the cow, already a middle stage or transition to a higher kind of begetting and a virgin birth?